The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Matthew.
Glory to you, Lord.
When John the Baptist heard in prison of the works of Christ, he sent his disciples to Jesus with this question: Are you the one who is to come, or should we look for another? Jesus said to them in reply, Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind regain their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have the good news proclaimed to them. And blessed is the one who takes no offense at me. As they were going off, Jesus began to speak to the crowds about John. What did you go out to the desert to see? A reed swayed by the wind? Then what did you go out to see? Someone dressed in fine clothing? Those who wear fine clothing are in royal palaces. Then why did you go out? To see a prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, Behold, I am sending my messenger ahead of you. He will prepare your way before you. Amen, I say to you, among those born of women, there has been none greater than John the Baptist. Yet the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, Lord Jesus Christ.
This third Sunday of Advent, I would like for us to conclude our three-week series on three stages in the spiritual life, one or another of which probably each one of us will fall. My suggestion at the beginning of Advent being that we make good use of this penitential season, which unfortunately we often ignore, fast-forwarding, unfortunately, to Christmas. The first Sunday, I described to you, taking cues from the scriptures, the Catholic who probably practices the faith and yet, perhaps secretly, perhaps publicly, still accommodates serious sin in his or her life. This is a Christian who has not yet really experienced deeper conversion unto Christ, still reserving a place in their life for things that are grievously offensive to God. And so I mentioned some of those which might be common in our day. The Catholic who misses Mass, the Catholic who contracepts, Catholic who is in an adulterous relationship, the Catholic who has serious and regular sins of lust, the Catholic who commits sacrilege in reception of the Eucharist unworthily. Those would not be uncommon sins, even for a Catholic who practices the faith. But that was a person who was at the lowest level. Moving up then, last Sunday, again taking a theme from the scriptures, that of wheat and chaff, and explaining that chaff, the husk of the wheat kernel, looks exactly like a wheat kernel except for the fact that it's hollow. I propose to you the hollow Catholic. This is basically the pharisaical Catholic, the Catholic who is concerned with externals but is lacking internals. The Catholic who has left behind and said no to really serious sin, still fighting against ordinary sin, of course, as everyone is, and yet displeasing to God, not because of grievous sin, but because of a lack of fruitfulness. As I said, the Christian life must be much, much more than merely the absence of evil. It must be positively the doing and cultivation of good for God, the hollow Catholic. And so now we conclude with the highest level. And this is the person who is, let us say, ordinarily holy. Ordinarily holy. The saints among us. The person who has left behind serious sin. The person who is practicing the faith, but not only on the outside, also has gone deeper and done that difficult work of the heart and the mind and the will. And the person who would have the potential, if they, let's say, were became famous, of being canonized, if the church chose to hold them up as a universal example. Of course, we remember every All Saints Day, thanks be to God, the saints are many, many, many more than only the few thousand who are in the canon of saints. They are, please God, in the millions or billions of holy souls who are with the Lord and one another in heaven. And I'm going to talk to you about such a soul in just a minute, somebody who will never be canonized, and, you know, in only a few decades will be forgotten, and yet is, I think, probably with the Lord and the saints in heaven, an ordinary saint whom I knew. First, though, if I may, I want to explain something about the gospel. This scene of John the Baptist in prison. You remember that he preached correctly to the king that he shouldn't be with his brother's wife, taking her as if she was his own wife. So he was preaching truth there against this sinful relationship. And so the king had him arrested. You remember the story. The woman, Herodias, harbored a hateful grudge against him, and then when an opportunity presented itself, when the king had too much to drink, she was able to have John executed in prison. So John now is in prison, and he sends his disciples to Jesus to ask, "Are you the one who is to come, or should we look for another?" So interpreters throughout all the Christian centuries have fallen more or less into one of two camps. There's one interpretation of this which proposes that there is no way that John could have had any question about Jesus being the Christ, and that rather it was his disciples who were questioning, and so rather than answer the question for them, he, the man of impenetrable faith, sends them back to Jesus with the question. But John isn't the one who has the question. Okay, that is one interpretation, and it's a legitimate one. However, that is not the interpretation that I side with. The other one being that, in fact, it was the Baptist who was questioning, and so he sent his disciples as emissaries. Of course, he had no way of encountering Jesus himself. And I base this interpretation on two things. One is the way that Jesus concludes his message back to John. He says, go and tell him what you see and hear, namely that I am performing all of these miracles which demonstrate that I am the Christ. And then he says, and blessed is the one who takes no offense at me. Now you remember that his cousin, the Baptist, was a fiery preacher. I mean, if you want to talk about fire and brimstone, John the Baptist was that kind of preacher. Burning the chaff with unquenchable fire, his winnowing fan is in his hand. So clearly that was his expectation of the Messiah. Then he is not hearing that about Jesus. Jesus is not, if you will, quite the fire and brimstone preacher. Doesn't seem to be as much as John was anyway. And so it seems that Jesus, in pointing John to these fulfillment miracles, also adds, don't take offense at me. Just because I am not being the Christ in the way that you envisioned the Christ being, blessed are you if you take no offense at me. Don't be scandalized by that. But the other thing has to do with the environment that John is in. Now, as a priest, I respond to calls from the imprisoned. And in fact, more than that, not every priest in our area is one of the certified chaplains for our local jail, but I am. I don't know about you, if you've spent time in prison or in jail. I hope you haven't. But I have. Of course, our good deacon, Warner, has made it a mark of his ministry for years and years to give up a weekend of every month to go into Montana State Prison to minister to the inmates there. And we remember that the Lord says in the parable of the final judgment, separation of the sheep and the goats, I was imprisoned and you visited me, or you didn't visit me. So I certainly want to try to respond to everyone who requests a visit from a priest. And I can tell you that prisons and jails are places of terrible, terrible, terrible human suffering. They are tragically necessary, but I can go in through the security doors and become momentarily an authorized prisoner myself, and already begin to sense the gloom that comes from being in a first world jail, where there's paint on the walls and the floor is clean and the bathrooms exist and the food is sanitary and there are books to read and electric light and heat in the winter and air conditioning in the summer. And yet, even spending a short amount of time in there, I am so grateful to leave and have liberty again, have freedom again, and I have to leave behind all of these poor people who remember, of course, are strangers to each other, and they won't be able to see any natural light, they won't be able to hear a bird sing, they won't see a leaf on a tree, they can't do what they want to do, and they're bored. If you remember from the lockdown of a couple of years ago, how restless we all became, how depressed we all became, how sad, you know, not being able to see our loved ones and so on. Well, imagine that being maybe years. Okay, this is that condition. Now, the Baptist is also in prison, but he's in a prison of 2,000 years ago. There's no heat. There's no air conditioning. Who could even imagine what the food would be like? There's probably no light. It's probably freezing. It's miserable. There's no books to read. There are no visitors, coming in and doing programs or anything like that. It is pure misery. It's probably an ancient prison would be akin probably to like a concentration camp, you know? So, terrible, terrible suffering and isolation. And when we suffer and when we are isolated, we begin to go into our minds and all kinds of doubts and questions and thoughts can come. And I do not think that it is any disrespect to the greatness of John the Baptist to say that he, being a human and a sinner, just as we are humans and sinners, would in that terrible suffering and isolation, hearing things from the outside but not being able to experience them completely, would maybe begin to wonder, was I wrong? Was I wrong about my cousin, Jesus? Is he the one? Or is he not the one? So I tend to side with the interpreters that suggest that the crushing weight of his isolation and suffering led to his having a sincere question that needed an answer. Okay, now I acknowledge the legitimacy also of the other interpretation. Point being, all of the scriptures of the third Sunday of Advent, all of the scriptures of this Mass concern endurance in hardship. Endurance in hardship. And that is what I want to talk to you about this Gaudete Sunday. Endurance in the midst of suffering. Isaiah said, strengthen the hands that are feeble. Make firm the knees that are weak. Say to those whose hearts are frightened, be strong, fear not. Again, St. James said to us, be patient, brothers and sisters, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient with it until it receives the early and the late rains? You too must be patient. Make your hearts firm. Take as an example of hardship and patience, brothers and sisters, the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Okay, since the prophets all suffered, and many of them were martyred, precisely because they were doing God's will. They were being his mouthpiece. Okay, they became saints. The Baptist was a prophet, and he became a saint. He became a martyr. I don't know about you, but I've reflected about John the Baptist over the years, and just the disgusting tragedy of the way that he died. Here, this man is described by Jesus as the greatest man who has ever been born of women. And then what happens? He angers a woman by rightly and lovingly pointing out to her husband, you shouldn't be with her. She harbors such a grudge that she uses her power in the midst of a debaucherous party to have an executioner just sent down into the dungeon and lop his head off. And that's it. And it's all over. And that is his inglorious end. There in the dark, he doesn't know what's coming. He's sitting down there, probably freezing and miserable, thinks it's just like any other day, and then the cell opens and there's a man with a sword and grabs him and comes outside. That's it. And I've always thought to myself, that is just so, so tragic that the greatest man who had ever lived in the estimation of Jesus Christ ends that way. But that's how he ended. And then, over the years, as I studied the lives of the saints and preached on their feast days and memorials and learned more about them, I've noticed something. Perhaps you have too. That these holy, loving, serving, remarkable, heroic Christians, all, I think it seems without exception, all go through periods of extraordinary suffering, which seems so unjust given how wonderful they are. This seems to be absolutely consistent. Why did Mary have to endure watching her son tortured to death? Why did St. Peter have to be crucified upside down in the middle of a racetrack in Rome that he was trying to convert? Why did Mother Teresa have to suffer such intense desolation for decades that she wondered whether she was really in communion with God? Why did St. Maximilian Kolbe or St. Edith Stein have to have their life's work destroyed, be sent to a Nazi concentration camp, and their bodies incinerated? Why did Pope John Paul, a man of great charisma and physical vigor and energy, why did he have to endure years and years of physical degeneration due to Parkinson's? And you could go on and on. I told you that I'd share with you an example of a holy soul, an ordinary saint, not in the canon, an example of somebody who also had to manifest this. And I hope, have you known holy people? Like really holy people? I hope you have. I certainly have. And last week I cautioned against judging ourselves well. That was the error of the Pharisees, right? I thank you, God, that I am not like the rest of humanity. You know, I'm holy. Well, but it is acceptable in the Christian tradition to recognize holiness in other people. Otherwise, we wouldn't have canonized saints, right? And I knew in my own fallen estimation, an ordinary saint when I was, from the time that I was a boy and then growing up. I've mentioned her before, but I'll mention her again. Grandma Gilbaugh. Now, this picture, which I have in my living room here, of sweet little Alice Gilbaugh, she's probably about 90 in this picture. I'll take it out after Mass so that you can see her cute little face there. My Grandma Gilbaugh, Alice, if she were alive today, would be 110 years old. Born in 1912, died in 2008, actually, just before I became your pastor. And she was 96 years old, so hers was a very, very long life. And it was also a life of suffering. She was born into a poor family in Clackamas, Oregon. Her father, my great-grandfather, was a stonemason, inhaled all of the dust from the cutting the stone, died when she was only 12 years old, lost her beloved father. But then grew up into her 20s, meets Paul Gilbaugh, handsome, wonderful, from my understanding, extremely gentle, sweet man, Catholic. She was not. She was a member of the Congregational Church. Became a Catholic. Why? Because she wanted to marry Paul Gilbaugh. And but then became a very, very serious and devout Catholic. But then they get married, and what do they want to do? They want to have kids. But they can't. They're infertile. And any one who is any couple that's been infertile knows, or if you've known a couple that's infertile, that's a terrible, terrible suffering. For years and years they tried to have children, they couldn't. And then finally a priest connected them with the circumstances of my father and that unplanned pregnancy, and they adopted my dad. And so everything is going along well for a few years. And then my grandfather, Paul, he developed a tumor, and he was 49 years old, not much older than I am now, and went in for a surgery, and it was successful, but an infection set in. And certainly now, I think, you know, he would have been fine, but he died of the infection at age 49, and my grandma was now a widow at only age, 48. Widow in her 40s, finished raising my father. But then my father joined the Air Force and left. And then she was alone. And she was alone for many, many years. She mourned terribly the loss of her husband, whom she loved so dearly. She once confessed to my mother that there was a year in which she cried every single day. She had no children around. She had no grandchildren around. She had to go to work in the company business to take my grandfather's place. And then, happily for her, my parents moved back to Portland. Dad left the Air Force when Mom was pregnant with me. And she absolutely adored having grandchildren. I mean, who could blame her? Consider, you know, the grandchildren. My sister and myself, idyllic children. Her family back, her new grandchildren, we were just the love of her life, along with God, of course. But then there was yet more suffering to come. Some of which does not bear detailing, but it certainly included the decline of health in her older years, and obviously those were many years. Some terrible sufferings on the part of people who took advantage of her. Some sufferings on the part even of family members. And then, of course, I left, Lisa left, and she was just there for many years, again alone, until she passed away. Sadly, I was not able to take the phone call when she was dying that my dad rang me up to put her on the line, but I remember it very distinctly. Her last words to me in a very gravelly voice were, "Goodbye, honey. I'll see you in heaven." This is a woman who, some years before that, when she had another health episode and thought she was dying, determined that the best thing that she could do would be to get into bed and start reading the catechism. Okay, so we're talking about a fairly holy person, and I can testify to the fact that there was not an iota of pride in Alice Gilbaugh, at least not by the time that I came to know her, and she was an old lady at that point. Sweet, loving, caring, concerned only with other people, bearing hardships and sufferings and humiliations, and never turning her back on the Lord, practicing her faith, praying every day, probably in heaven, because if she's not, I'm in real trouble, and so are you, probably. But I think that she is probably with the Lord. There is a lived example from my own life of precisely the principle that I was illustrating in the lives of saints that you know. A person who is other-centered, who is God-centered, who is loving, who is not prideful, who is not sinful in any serious way, who is not hollow, but but full and deep and substantial. And yet, why such suffering? Pope John Paul wrote a letter on this very matter during his pontificate on the meaning of suffering. And I'd just like to quote to you one little paragraph from it. Towards the end, he concludes, "Suffering is present in the world in order to release love. Suffering is present in the world in order to release love. In order to give birth to works of love toward neighbor. In order to transform the whole of human civilization into a civilization of love. In this love, the saving meaning of suffering is completely accomplished and reaches its definitive dimension. Christ's words about the final judgment enable us to understand this in all the simplicity and clarity of the gospel." Well, I think that it goes without saying that we're all afraid of suffering, and that rare indeed would be the Christian who is so holy as to delight in suffering or seek out suffering, though such Christians do exist. In the book that we have given out for Advent, which I'm almost through, by the way, super, super easy read, absolute gold inside. It's just nothing but quotes from saints. I thought that I would share a few with you by way of conclusion. Wisdom from saints, that is, from canonized holy people who were heroic lovers and yet also suffered greatly. So whatever they have to say to us about suffering, whatever they have to say to us about patience, whatever they have to say to us about endurance in hardship, these are credible people. Saint Pachomius said, "It is through patience that the saints received all that was promised to them." It was through patience that the saints received all that was promised to them. Indeed, we see in the lives of the saints, precisely because they were people who did not turn their backs on God, who didn't stop practicing the faith, who didn't reject the Lord in anger, who didn't say, "I'm done," one day, but persevered, patiently enduring, that the Lord unfolded all of the graces of holiness within them. Why did they become holy? Because they were born that way? No, precisely because they endured patiently through suffering. Blessed Sebastian Wolf, man with whom I'm not familiar, blessed, wrote concerning physical ailments, quote, "Every illness and every trial is permitted by God as the means whereby we can best ensure our salvation." Every illness and every trial is permitted by God as the means whereby we can best ensure our salvation. So, God always knows what is best. Perhaps he knows, if I didn't let you have cancer, your soul might be lost because you would turn your back on me and embrace the world in your final years rather than turn toward me and away from the world that you're leaving. Who knows? God does. We don't. Saint Isidore said, "The more we are afflicted in this world, the greater is our assurance in the next. The more we sorrow in the present, the greater will be our joy in the future." Saint Isidore said, "The more we are afflicted in this world, the greater is our assurance in the next. The more we sorrow in the present, the greater will be our joy in the future. Yeah, I remember one time standing with my grandma at my grandfather's grave. We would go up there to tend the stone, which would get overgrown, and put flowers there. And our little ritual was always to pray one Hail Mary, Our Father, and Glory Be. And of course, I never knew him. He died years before I was born. But I remember one time in which she started to cry, and she held my hand. She was just crying there. We're talking 40, 50 years. Well, yeah, probably closer to 40 years after she had lost her husband, and she is still so in love with the man, just suffering, crying there. And I thought to myself, why is it that God would have allowed this separation of such beautiful love and my grandmother to suffer? Now, the very particular answer to that question, of course, could never be answered. But, you know, just sort of facing the nature of suffering there. Well, one of my favorite saints is quoted in this book, St. Ignatius of Loyola. He was the patron saint of my parish growing up. I consider him to be one of my spiritual fathers. And I had never heard this quote from him until I read it in the book. So we'll conclude with this great thought of this great saint. He said, "If God causes you to suffer much, it is a sign that he has great designs for you and that he certainly intends to make you a saint." Well, if Alice Gilbaugh is a saint, then certainly the suffering that she endured in her life contributed to that holy end. So again, St. Ignatius, if God causes you to suffer much, it is a sign that he has great designs for you and that he certainly intends to make you a saint.